Organization that sprang up to address global injustice, global inequalities, and global socioeconomic exploitation and expropriations by the Western world.
Dr. Imam Mukhtar says the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a change that was inspired by Iranians who have had enough.
It was a unique revolution that was led and driven by individuals, groups, young people and all the like, who saw a frustration with the system, which was with the Shah regime, which was not only pro-West, but then subduing the people within the domestic environment. And it was a collective responsibility.
Experts believe that one of the significant outcomes of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was turning Iran into a power in the Middle East region with even influence in global affairs. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop the slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end this slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If the United States will continue or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
The European Union Agency for Asylum, EUAA, says new refugee applications in the 27-country bloc are at a five-year high, mainly being submitted by Afghans and Syrians. On Wednesday, 19 refugees were found dead on the border between Turkey and EU nation Greece. It's believed they died from hypothermia. The European Commission claims it's trying to gather further information. EU Home Affairs ministers have been meeting to try and advance the bloc's new refugee policy, known as the Migration Pact.
The strategy of all or nothing up to now has actually given us nothing, and this is not good for member states or the European Union. We want to breathe new life into the EU Migration Pact.
When it comes to the refugee crisis, civil society organizations and many EU lawmakers make the point that the West never learns from its mistakes. They are expressing concern that stoking tensions with Russia over Ukraine has the potential to create a new refugee crisis. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. As the EU's Poland and Lithuania construct a new wall along their borders with Belarus, the European Commission is promising billions of euro to expand and arm the bloc's border agency, Frontex.
Frontex is by far the biggest agency we ever had. And we are setting it up right now, and it's huge. It's going to have 10,000 armed people at our external borders.
The EU's own data shows 100,000 children and teenagers go missing in the bloc every year. Most of those are refugees. Campaigners are calling for greater cooperation between police forces.
There need to be better information sharing platforms so we know exactly how many children are going missing and what are the actual risks that they face, because right now, nobody knows.
With EU nations refusing to take in refugees, and as billions are spent on keeping them out, rights groups are again asking, where are the bloc's much trumpeted values? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In overcrowded dinghies and often in the cover of darkness, migrants, among them people running away from wars and instability, take to the choppy waters separating France from the UK. Some make it. Others die trying. 27 of them in November last year alone. An incident that further strained the fragile ties between Paris and London. French President Emmanuel Macron says Britain's reliance on illegal immigrant labor is behind the surge in numbers crossing from France and in their deaths.
I think it's definitely political because he's getting set to run his election campaign. You know, we've had Brexit as well, so we know that that has impacted, but the reality is we're talking about human beings. So this is not about political point scoring, or it shouldn't be about political point scoring between governments.
Britain says the French president is absolutely wrong, that the government here is searching for ways to stop the crossings. This is what Interior Minister Priti Patel had to say in the wake of those tragic deaths in November.
We're not working just to end these crossings because we don't care or we're heartless. There's no quick fix. This is about addressing long-term pull factors, smashing criminal gangs that treat human beings as cargo, and tackling supply chains.
To do that, Britain wants France to let British police patrol French beaches. It has ruled out physically pushing boats back across the English Channel. It wants to give people traffickers life sentences and has introduced a controversial bill that will allow it to send migrants to detention centers in other countries. To campaigners, that is draconian and racist.
The Nationality and Borders Bill seeks to make it even more difficult for people to seek asylum in Britain, which again is a contravening international human rights laws. It will also mean that there's a higher scrutiny of people. There are tighter deadlines as it stands.
More than 28,000 migrants crossed the English Channel in 2021, triple the number the year before.
And while British and French leaders continue to trade accusations, more desperate migrants will embark on that perilous journey across the English Channel, and that will almost certainly mean more deaths. Saeed Pariza, London.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the US-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gelly, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally. For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution.
The Iranian Revolution, as I mentioned, it tells us how you don't have to have only one model of political system, whereby, I mean, here in this country, we have a monarch who is head of a national church, but it's a farce. In reality, God has been pushed out of a public sphere, and so the whole thing is a charade. In Iran, there is a valuable presence of faith in the public sphere.
As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here, and they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth, they're thriving as well. They have a strong military, they have strong regional allies, they have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London. Come April, many Britons will have to choose between heating and eating. Everything from bus fares to mortgages are going to cost more. Interest rates have gone up twice in 7 weeks, and three more hikes are on the horizon as the central bank tries to tackle the situation. The opposition members of parliament are livid, saying the government is incompetent.
He doesn't like it, Mr. Speaker. When children in my constituency go to bed with no food in their tummies, with no heat in their homes, what does he really think is the honourable position of a Chancellor who has just allowed one of his policies directly to be taken in fraud, £4.3 billion of fraud under his watch? Any other Chancellor that I've known would come to the House today to resign.
This week, millions learnt that their gas and electricity bills are going to jump 54%. The government says there's nothing it can do, with energy prices going up worldwide.
I don't believe them at all. You know, I'm sure they know, you know, and this is just to put people more in poverty, you know. And it's not right, it's not fair, you know. People working very hard.
When you look at the price of things, you know, everything going up higher than it was. And that's why so many people on the street, living on the street, because they can't afford to eat or drink.
Oh, I feel like it's government responsible to support people who are in this horrible situation, because
I had a problem this year myself. I couldn't find an apartment because the prices went up crazy twice.
Also causing inflation to rise is supply chain issues, higher import taxes and wages increasing. Brexit, the pandemic and a global energy crisis, a perfect storm for Britain, now in the grips of its worst economic slump in 300 years. But who will have to pay for it all?
On April 1st, the cost of living will be going up £3,000 a year for each household. On the very same day, British politicians will be getting a £2,000 a year pay rise. From this, it is clear that those that are on top of the pile have their bills covered, and it's those on the breadline that will be picking up those bills. Bianca Rahimi, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrumentation.
The Spotlight.
Very grim assessment when it comes to the UK's energy bills and, in turn, its economy. Energy bills to rise by over 50% in the month of April, based on the regulator in the UK, which has announced price hikes. An estimated 22 million households will see their energy costs increase. Can these households afford that in the age of COVID? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why rising energy costs are not the only problems plaguing UK's economy, the economy which has not been able to adapt itself since Brexit. Let's get the latest on this. Rob Carter is our correspondent joining us from London. Rob, at this point, looking at this increase of 50%, it's quite incredible. It is set to start in the month of April, but I was under the assumption that the energy costs have risen already. And of course, tell us what the government intends to do, because I think they do have a quick fix for this in a sense.
Well, energy costs are just one aspect which people are concerned about here in the UK. The price of living in general is on the increase. You'll remember from past reporting that petrol prices are at least four times higher than they were the same time last year. There's also inflation taking place. People are having to pay more in order to get their day-to-day food groceries, among many other things. And this energy bill crisis is just the latest in a long line of increased living costs which are plaguing the country. It's reached a point now where people are very concerned about whether or not they can even pay off their mortgages, meaning that many people going forward may be in a position where they're going to have to choose between either eating a meal, paying their mortgage, or putting the heating on during the cold months. So the situation here is very concerning for the majority of people. The government, of course, is still chewing over what plans it's going to take in order to reduce this in the future. But it's the Chancellor and also the Bank of England have been very, very clear that going forward in the immediate terms, things are going to get hard for people. And the government is in no position to deny the fact that people are going to have to pay more, including an increase on immediate bills, including national insurance and things like that. Of course, there are other things which are coming into play over the next few months. Protest movements such as Insulate Britain, which have been long campaigning through direct action to try and force the government to insulate homes, to save people money on their bills and to keep people warm during the cold months. They've announced that they will return to their radical direct action plan going forward, and they intend to be more ambitious than they were last year. And this is the group which, of course, was shutting down motorways, causing major disruption across the UK, and has a very controversial legacy in itself, putting the government in more difficult waters as to dealing with this crisis. So obviously, going forward, things are likely to get harder rather than better.
We appreciate it. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosselin joining us from Bristol. Also joining us, journalist and political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So we have all UK cast here. That's great in this sense. Tony Gosling, let me start with you. We heard our correspondent there. I'm curious about this energy, rise in energy, in particular, I guess, when it comes to households and the gas set to increase by 50% based on the stat I'm looking at here. What's interesting here is that the Britain's energy regulator can cap the price, but it couldn't do it beyond the 50% rise. It couldn't cap it or bring down the price or lower it. Is that because the energy companies are privatized and therefore they can't set the price, and that's the best that it could do at this point, the energy regulator?
Well, in a way, you've put your finger on the main problem here, and that is that although they are supposed to be able to regulate the energy market, they can't regulate the energy market, because if all of the energy companies get together and hike up the price of gas, as they have done, so there's much more gas, American gas, going to China at the moment. And as Putin pointed out a couple of months ago, this is the main reason why these energy prices in Europe are going up, because they can't get as much easy, cheap gas as they were doing from the United States. And the fact that this sort of thing is left to the vagaries of a market actually has enabled these energy companies to make vast, vast profits. What we've seen just literally last week announced by Shell, a 14-fold increase, 14 times more profits and money going to their shareholders through share dividends than the previous quarter. So a massive amount of money is being made by these privatized energy companies. What, of course, should happen is that these industries, because they are misbehaving, profiteering off the backs of ordinary working people in Britain, they should be simply renationalized. They should be requisitioned by the government, and then they can start to actually charge the cost price, which is what these utilities should be charging for the energy that people are using. It was interesting. I was just looking at the when it was all privatized. This is the gas and also BP, the golden share in petroleum that was privatized in the Thatcher years. It was NM Rothschild and Sons that managed that privatization. These are very powerful investment bankers. And you have to ask, who's in charge? We ask this all the time with Boris. Who's really running the show? And I think it shows you that the City of London has actually got far more power than the politicians that we elect, when they can be involved in lobbying and arranging for these industries, which we all need, part of our national assets under the ground, to be sold off to private interests. Then also, sure. I would say, we had a couple of months ago fuel shortages orchestrated during the party conference season by the petrol companies here in Britain. So queues outside petrol stations, there was no real fuel shortage. They were doing this deliberately to push the prices up, make more profits, as they've just announced they made, and also to show the world and show the country and show the politicians who's in charge. That is to say that these massive energy conglomerates backed by the City of London are far more powerful than our politicians, I'm afraid.
That's another angle to this, which is very interesting. We're going to get into that. Simonson Abbas, taking a look at what is happening to the UK, starting with the topic at hand, which was the energy hike in prices. There's a vast array of, there's so many things that are going wrong for the UK, but this particular one hits UK households pretty hard. 22 million British households are connected to the country's gas grid. Can you give us your assessment of how vast the problem this is?
Well, I think on the ground, it's a huge problem, because, you know, those at the poverty-stricken end, and there's substantial numbers of those in Britain, are going to feel a pinch immediately, because when you're talking about this scale of hike in prices, of course, people are going to then have to make choices, and the kind of choices they're making are, do I keep my heating on, or do I eat food? I mean, these are literally the decisions that many, say, pensioners or people who are unemployed or people who have been, you know, down and out for a while on their luck are having to make. And this is a situation that was entirely avoidable because, you know, of course, we've had the debacle of Brexit, which was a premeditated self-annihilation exercise that Boris was personally very much involved in creating. We've had the supposed Omicron virus preceded by the Delta, preceded by COVID, whatever else it was in its very initiation, which has been a sort of a litany of impending economic disasters that was being built up over that time. So it's hardly a surprise as to what's happening now. Most of us who are in the know have been saying this is exactly what's going to happen. But you can't blame it all on the virus, etc. This is a kind of gross mismanagement on the part of the government. They've underestimated the Brexit scenario quite deliberately, I'd rather suspect.
Sure.
They've underestimated the COVID aspect quite deliberately as well.
Okay. Well, I saw you nodding there, Tony Gosling, except when Simon and Abbas start talking about Brexit. Then you stopped. I'm wondering why. But tell us about Brexit and promises that Boris Johnson made. He was supposed to cut the VAT on fuel bills. And he has decided not to do that, so which is said to give this rise or be one of the factors for this rise by 54%. Why didn't Prime Minister Johnson follow through with his promise?
Well, of course, it's because Johnson is not necessarily in charge. He has to take advice of the city and his very powerful chancellor, the billionaire Rishi Sunak, the guy from Goldman Sachs. So there are all sorts of people around who have got also a very big say in what goes on. Boris he's being pulled. He's like a tug of war. He's being pulled in various different directions. Sometimes one lobby wins, another time another lobby wins. But I don't think he's a man of specific principles. He's the sort of politician who will try and go with the flow. Whichever way it seems he's going to manage to survive, he will go that way. And so when he's being pulled in this, I mean, it's absolutely right what you're saying about the horrific conditions here in Britain for ordinary people. It's been getting worse really since the 1970s. Slowly but surely, people's living standards have been eroded. Job opportunities are getting worse and worse. The unions are able less and less to keep people's wages at a reasonable level. There's increasing unemployment. There's now the expectation that both the man and the woman in a household must go to work in order to afford to pay, to buy their own home and to make sure kids go to nursery and this sort of thing. So there's massive increases on the finances. But if you look at the structural changes that have been going on, and this is the latest, this really does take the biscuit. I mean, what we've been seeing has gradually been happening over the years. But these fuel increases are a massive increase in that. It's almost an exponential rise. It's because the economy has shifted from a manufacturing and service economy into a financial economy. And what those financial economy, financialized infrastructure, is all the basic things we need, things like housing, water, all the basics. Those is where there's big investment
but that's been
and there's
going on for a while.
Profit of those.
But that's been going on for a while, if I'm correct to say that, Tony Gosling, in terms of the UK turning out to become this financial focused economy where the money is made, as opposed to what it used to have, which was a lot of manufacturing jobs. But I got to ask this next question from you, Seymour and Abbas, because it's very perplexing reading how thousands die because they can't afford heating bills in the UK. More than 2,700 people to have died each year in England and in Wales because they can't afford to keep their homes warm. And then what was more interesting was this is back in 2011. So I'm guessing that figure is higher now. Tell us how this happens and why it seems like the UK government either doesn't care or has learned to adapt to this grim fatality rate as a result, and how much worse it can get with this 54% rise in gas prices or energy prices.
Well, what they've done in Britain since neoliberalism has taken hold of this country in a full way post Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher was the one who ushered it all in back in the 80s. Since then, what we've seen is the delusion of the British, what I call, still call, the working class. Because what they were conned into believing was that they'd somehow become middle class and that they were sort of part of a gravy train which could go and buy their own houses, they could go on several holidays a year, they could expect to spend what they liked in restaurants, go out and have sort of those kind of perks, which I guess people would regard as normal activities now. But of course, for the last 20 years, we've seen that wages haven't been increased, not of the average person. They might have for parliamentarians and others, but for the average person, in real terms, wages haven't gone up. Contrast that with food prices and general cost of living. that's gone up considerably. So you can see that inflation, British households naturally are being hit by inflation, and it's the highest rate of inflation for a decade, as far as I can work out from the research I've done. And, of course, that hasn't been arrested by the government. In fact, they've just been printing more money and throwing it at the problem. Now, the thing is, printing money is a habit which has been given to them by the money lenders. And I think Tony was quite right in pointing out to the real problem that Britain has is that they've bought into this idea that you can basically carry on printing your way, printing money out your way out of the problems. Well, sooner or later, any economist knows that that is not going to be the reality of the solution. And until, for instance, a government stops and until they invest in real infrastructure, get energy resources. For instance, in this country, why on earth has no government invested in tidal energy? We're surrounded by waves in this little island, and we can produce, I think we produce something like 10% of our natural energy resources a year from tidal waves, etc., and the coast, but we haven't invested in it. We still rely on the carbon.
Well, that may be part of the green... That could be part of the green movement that or actions that is under that umbrella, maybe. I don't have information on that. But you talked about printing money, and, of course, that's a perfect recipe, Tony Gosling, for inflation, which the UK is experiencing. It's now a 30-year high. A source indicating it's up to about 7%. But is it – I mean, when we hear that, then I'm about to ask you, but haven't prices gone up a lot more? I talked to our correspondent just days ago, and he said price of margarine has quadrupled. I'm wondering what everyday items, how much prices have increased, something that comes at the top of your mind, which then translates to the poor and how they can't afford the amount of price increases that's occurring.
Okay, so I think that that actually inflation is not being driven by the quantitative easing, the printing of money, because that's been going on for since really at least 2008, the massive bailouts of the banks that took place then. The reason is because mainly around, I think, energy prices going up, because that has a knock-on effect on everybody. So the food producers have to pay more, so the prices start to go up in the shops. That's, I think, what's causing this inflation. And I would say what we've seen over the last year or so, somewhere between 5 and 10% inflation in basic food prices, the sort of things that people need to survive. That, I think, is been the main driver of the prices going up. But I think there is a bigger problem, and that is this green agenda. We've seen, there's very good aims of the Greens, but we've seen these added extra taxes onto fuel going on because of this. And also, as Mohsin said there, the failure to invest in really good, reliable, cheap green energy like tidal energy. I live in Bristol, which has got one of the highest tidal reaches in the world, along with Newfoundland. And we could very easily have a tidal energy system here. They blocked it time and time and time again. And that's because there's not enough profits in it. There's more profits in the fossil fuel industries. And also, there's a whole gravy train developed around other types of green, so-called green energy. So the green has been actually a major problem. For example, finding that the electricity grid in Britain can hardly deliver its energy, and we have to switch on the one coal-fired power station we've still got left in order to keep energy going. So that has also been subsidised. Sure. All this green stuff has been subsidised, which has also pushed energy prices up. Remember Henry Kissinger? He said, this is a good few years, probably 30 years ago now, he said, you control the energy, you control the nations. And these energy companies are very powerful, and they work together in concert around the Western world, as you probably know. The other thing he said, by the way, was control the food and you control the people. And so by putting food prices up, make it more difficult to get hold of food, people are being driven in further into debt and into a form of wage slavery.
Right. Well, I'd like to capitalize on what you said in the beginning of the program, Tony Gosselin. I think you mentioned it there a little bit also. And say, Mohsin Abbas, that was when Tony Gosselin talked about Shell. Now, Shell has posted its highest quarterly profits in 8 years. That's a lot. But more alarming is that there wasn't a gas shortage or a petrol shortage. They were just keeping it to drive the prices higher. That is something that is plaguing a lot of different commodities or items, I should say. especially, for example, in the U.S. And I'm wondering if the U.K. is the same case, where you, because of COVID, people did not go out as much, did not purchase as much maybe, and now it's time to make the money, to make back the profits by increasing the prices even higher, which means the prices are not going to come down. Is that a correct way of looking at it, which means basically corporate greed is playing into the picture?
Very much so, and I think let's take it a step up now, because Vanguard and BlackRock, according to my research, are two companies who basically overarch most of the financial capital and the corporations of the world. Now, if we're living in the alternate reality where I'm meant to believe that there's free competition, free trade, and there's real corporations out there which are all fighting each other, then I could accept that, okay, there's a dog-eat-dog world out there. But I've increasingly started studying people like Professor Rodney Shakespeare and his take on binary economics and the solutions, and researching things like, for instance, the Bradbury Pound, which was something which Britain used as a way of kicking out the corporates, looking back at the way America once dealt with bankers as well. There is a precedent for solving these problems. And the precedent begins, first of all, with stopping the reliance on the guys who create the main debt, who use usury and use the interest mechanisms and the money system as a way of making all these things happen. And of course, energy companies and all these different corporates that fix the prices and sort of sit behind closed doors and decide what's going to happen, what's not going to happen. Then they come into play. But behind, let's take it another stage further back and look at the World Economic Forum, for example. Mr. Klaus Schwab, who has been harping on about the Agenda 2030 and the Great Reset, the Global Reset. And all of this involves the biggest transnational corporations in the world, whether there's two of them or dozens of them or whatever you believe. And it involves the state operators. These are clear-cut strategies and policies which hinge around...
I wonder if there was a bidding for that. It makes me wonder if there was a bidding for that to become part of this, as you said, great 2030 reset.
Well, yes. I mean, the thing is, if you believe in accidents and chaos in the economic world, then of course you just see things as a matter of symptoms and consequence and reactionary behavior. But sure. If you start seeing that actually there are players that have power to be able to influence those the economics, i.e. they control the means of production, they control the raw materials, they can create wars where they want, they can release viruses if they wanted to create chaos around the world, and they can also create propaganda
okay.
and create corporate
I got to jump in. Unfortunately, we're just running out of time, Samuel Senevas. I do apologize. And I figure I'm going to save this one for last, Tony Gosling. And this is what Rishi Sunak has said. The government does have a plan to help out, I guess, with the energy bills for average UK. But then he said, in terms of taxes, his mission was to cut taxes ahead of the next general election, scheduled for May 2024. Well, that's 2 years from now. How's that going to help people now?
Well, you know what? Today, Rishi Sunak has just blocked a recovery plan for the National Health Service too. I think if I was Boris Johnson, I would sack him today, because he's clearly showing policies which are simply there to beef up the profits of the biggest companies in the City of London. For example, Shell, their 14-fold rise in profits at the same time as the energy prices are going up consumers 50%.
Thank you for
now,
that.
This
I'm
really
sorry,
is.
Tony Gosling, we're just out of time.
Taking,
I do apologize. Thank you so
now.
Much. It was very riveting. This was great. Tony Gosling there, Sony investigative journalist from Bristol. Thank you so much for your contribution. And Samuel Senevas from London, thank you. Journalist and political commentator, also from London there. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kaveh Tahlai, it's goodbye until next time.
We here at IRIB English Radio congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's advice on writers and speakers whose main job was to find fault with the Islamic Republic system instead of kindly helping the system and the nation to overcome difficulties and shortages. Today, you're going to hear the Imam's views in his testament to clarify the Islamic economic system in comparison with the capitalist and socialist economies. Stay tuned, please. The period of Imam Khomeini's struggles against the despotic Pahlavi regime coincided with the Cold War era, in which the two Western and Eastern blocs were in conflict in various arenas. The West, symbolized by the US, was an advocate of capitalism, and the East, led by the former Soviet Union, was the propagator of socialism. In those times, except the non-aligned nations, all nations were affiliated and surrogate of one of the blocks of powers. In Iran, too, many thinkers and political activists believe that there is no third way and one should join one of the dominant camps to survive and be successful. But Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, ruling out both dominant ideologies, presented the matchless model of the Islamic Republic system of government and Islamic economy. He writes in his testament, Islam agrees neither with the oppressive, uncalculated capitalism, which deprives the oppressed masses, and rather condemns it seriously in the book, Quran, and the Sunnah, practice of the Prophet, and considers it opposite to social justice, nor with a regime like communism, Marxism, and Leninism, which are opposed to individual ownership and believe in partnership leading to a supportive dictatorship and despotism. Imam Khomeini, criticizing those who, out of unawareness and miscomprehension of Islam, try to justify wrong capitalist and socialist models and pave the way for opponents to attack Islam and the Islamic Republic, says, some people who miscomprehend and are unaware of the Islamic government and political issues ruling in Islam have pretended in their speech and writing that Islam, the unbounded supporter of capitalism and ownership, and with their false understanding of Islam, they have concealed the radiant image of Islam and opened the way for adversaries and enemies of Islam to assault Islam and to consider it a regime like the capitalist regime of the West, the US and Britain and other Western looters, and relying on the words and deeds of these ignorant, either out of bias and or stupidity, have embarked on opposing Islam without referring to real experts of Islam. Another group, due to miscomprehension and unawareness of Islam and its healthy economy, has also stood in the opposite side, and sometimes resorting to some verses of Quran or sentences of Nahjul Balagha, have introduced Islam favorable
the deviant schools of Marx and the like of him, and have not paid attention to other verses and parts of Nahjul Balagha, and through their imperfect understanding have stood up and follow the communist religion and support on faith, dictatorship, and suppressive suffocation, which ignores human values, and a minority party behaves human masses like animals. Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, Islam is a moderate regime which, recognizing ownership and respecting it in a limited way, finds the way for real ownership and consumption, which, if it were accurately practiced, the wheels of healthy economy would rotate and social justice, which is the requisite for a healthy regime, would materialize. The founder of the Islamic Republic recommends the officials, especially those of the judiciary, not to be affected by media pressure and propaganda and preserve human principles of individual ownership. He writes, "My bequest to the parliament, the guardian council, the government, the president, and the judicial council is to be humble before the rules of Almighty God, and do not be affected by the hollow propaganda of the oppressive pillaging pole of capitalism and the atheist communist pole, and respect legitimate ownership and capitals with Islamic bounds. And I assure the nation so that capitals and constructive activities are put in practice to take the government and the country of self-sufficiency and light and heavy industries." Imam Khomeini advises the rich in society in this way: "I make bequests to the rich and those who have legitimate money to spend your justly accumulated wealth and embark on constructive activity in farms, villages, and factories, as this is a valuable worship per se. And I make bequests to all to strive for the welfare of deprived classes, since your benefit in this world and the hereafter is through attending to the deprived of society who have been in trouble throughout the period of the royal oppression and the Khans. And how good it is if the well-to-do classes voluntarily would provide homes and welfare for the inhabitants of slums. And be sure that the benefit of this world and the hereafter depends on it, and it is not fair at all that one is homeless while other one has apartments." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, continues in his testament, "My bequest to that group of clergymen and quasi-clergymen who are opposed to the Islamic Republic and its institutions with different motives and spend their time to overthrow it and help the conspiring opponents and political players, and sometimes, according to what is said, render huge assistance to this end with the exorbitant monies that they receive from godless capitalists, is to apologize before God till the door of penitence is open, and to be consonant with the destitute oppressed nation and support the Islamic Republic, which has been achieved through self-sacrifice of the nation. This will be to your good in the world and the hereafter, although I doubt that you will succeed to repent."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.